A great deal has already been written about Hitler by historians, sociologists, psychologists, and psychoanalysts. As I attempt to show in the pages that follow, all his biographers have tried to exonerate his parents, particularly his father, thus refusing to explore what really happened to this man during his childhood, what experiences he stored up within, and what ways of treating other people were available as models for him. Once I was able to move beyond the distorting perspectives associated with the idea of a quote-unquote good upbringing, what is described in this book as poisonous pedagogy, and show how Hitler's childhood anticipated the later concentration camps, countless readers were amazed by the convincing evidence I presented for my view. At the same time, however, their letters expressed confusion. Basically, my childhood differed little from Hitler's. I, too, had a very strict upbringing, was beaten and mistreated. Why, then, didn't I become a mass murderer instead of, say, a scientist, a lawyer, a politician, or a writer? Actually, my book provides clear answers here, although they often seem to be overlooked. For example, Hitler never had a single other human being in whom he could confide his true feelings. He was not only mistreated, but also prevented from experiencing and expressing his pain. He didn't have any children who could have served as objects for abreacting. An abreaction is the expression of a previously repressed emotion achieved through reliving the experience that caused it. His hatred, and finally, his lack of education, did not allow him to ward off his hatred by intellectualizing it. Had a single one of these factors been different, perhaps he would never have become the arch criminal he did. On the other hand, Hitler was certainly not an isolated phenomenon. He could not have had millions of followers if they had not experienced the same sort of upbringing. I anticipated a great deal of resistance on the part of the public when I advanced this thesis, which I am convinced is a correct one. So I was surprised to discover how many readers, both young and old, agreed with me. They were familiar from their own backgrounds with what I depicted. I didn't have to adduce elaborate arguments. All I needed to do was describe Hitler's childhood in such a way that it served as a mirror, and suddenly Germans caught their own reflections in it. It was the personal nature of their responses to the three examples I present in my book that enabled many people to understand in a more than purely intellectual sense that every act of cruelty, no matter how brutal and shocking, has traceable antecedents in its perpetrator's past. The diverse reactions to my book range from unmistakable aha experiences to angry rejection. In the latter cases, as I have already indicated, the following comment keeps recurring like a refrain. Quote, I am living proof that beating or spanking children is not necessarily harmful, for in spite of it, I became a decent person, unquote. Although people tend to make a distinction between spanking and beating a child, considering the former a less severe measure than the latter, the line between the two is a tenuous one. I just heard a report on an American radio station about a man, a member of a Christian fundamentalist sect in West Virginia, who spanked, quote-unquote, his son for 2 hours. The little boy died as a result. But even when a spanking is a gentler form of physical punishment, violence, the psychic pain and humiliation and the need to repress these feelings are the same as in the case of more severe punishment. And I have a quick comment. What happens, I'm pondering, what happens to our thought process when feelings are frozen? And we're going to be exploring that in more depth next week. It's important to point this out so that readers who receive or give what they call spankings will not think they or their children are exempt from the consequences of child beating discussed in this book.